You're here to sign up for a bill. You always do that on the left table. If you have any kind of electronic device, please turn it off so that you don't rudely interrupt our witnesses. Otherwise, we'll be asking you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. All right, first up, we have Senate Bill 589. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 589. Ms. Richardson, tell us what that bill does, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 589 requires the Department of Education to conduct a study on career and technical education during the 2007-2009 biennium, requires the department to report results of the study to the State Board of Education, appropriates money for the study, and directs the department to identify common name, consistent practices, and fee structures for 2+2 programs. It requires the development of applied baccalaureate degrees for selected high-growth and high-demand occupations. It replaces all statutory references to professional or technical education with career and technical education. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. We have 30 minutes assigned to this, and we have a lot of people signed up, and no one in opposition. So I'm going to ask you to keep your testimony brief so we can get through everyone. Senator Schrader, are you in the room?
Yes,
you want to come up? And is Deborah Barnes coming with you? Are you just going to?
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Barnes.
I'll get right to it, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us here. My name is Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 589. I'll give you a little background about why it's here and what I think our goal is, to give you some background, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Barnes to answer detailed questions. Senate Bill 589 actually is an outgrowth of a similar bill we introduced and we passed in this legislature last session.
That's a really bright yellow, I have to tell you. It was a wake-up call this morning. Thank you.
Your attention.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Senator Schrader, because these people all look familiar to me. So why are we back?
Why are we back? Well, we're back because despite our best efforts to establish a meaningful task force to look into the role of vocational education in our K-12 system, the appointments came very late. Some of the agencies seemed a little reluctant or unable to find the right people to assign to this committee. And in my opinion, I'd be curious what Ms. Barnes says, but my opinion, it just never really got rolling. And as a result, the committee felt that it really couldn't accomplish the work that was originally assigned to it from the last legislature. And so we're back this time actually putting a little more money into the task force to make sure it can actually accomplish its goals. And I'm hopeful, since we've gone through this process to some degree through last interim, that the appointments would be made quickly and that this task force will get off the ground running. I think also they learned a little bit in the course of their deliberations what needed to be done, getting their hands around what would be the best use of their time in terms of defining vocational education and career tech and what it should or should not be as part of our, frankly, pre-K-20 continuum of education. And my interest in this comes because I've seen from my vantage point in Ways and Means where we've got a lot of erstwhile vocational, career, technical education spread in a lot of different areas. Community college certainly is a huge area. There's workforce development monies both in and out of the community college system, economic development. We're seeing some interest now in the university systems with some of the nursing programs and these types of things, looking for very, very career, vocation-oriented types of education as opposed to the more classical liberal arts type of education. And one of my biggest concerns in looking at the Ways and Means budgets and the education budgets is, well, what about starting these kids earlier? What about in high school? You know, why is vocational ed seeming, in my opinion, to be morphing into a post K-12 type of thing, you know, displaced workers only or finally people getting into community college? One of the problems I think we've had with our CAM is that it never became CAM. It became more of a thesis for seniors in high school, a little more esoteric than I had envisioned it, which would have been working closely with the business and labor communities, developing regional centers perhaps for our high schools to get kids interested in education, to put their hands around something, to feel like they matter. One of the agenda items, I think we have this coming session, and I would suggest in the next few years, is to develop a true pre-K-20 type of approach to education and get these young people interested in things, show them the relevance of math, show them the relevance of science, show them the relevance of their education system early on. Not everyone's going to go to a four-year college, frankly. That's just the real world. And we want these other people to be very successful. There's a graying of not just some of the engineering professions or social worker professions, but there's a graying, frankly, of the men and women interested in mechanics and having basic skills that make our society and our world go around and, quite frankly, pay a lot better than some of the four-year institutional types of degrees you get when you come out. So, long story short, Madam Chair, I think it's time to reinvestigate or reinvest, probably both, vocational education's role in our K-12 system so that we can get these kids started right so we can go into our community college system and workforce development and have a really excellent, excellent education system set up for all kids, no matter what their interests or aptitudes are.
Thank you, Senator Schrader. You know, we were pretty positive about this last session and had hoped it worked. I'm disappointed it didn't get off the ground. So I'll hear from Ms. Barnes next. I know you're concerned about outcomes.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I don't think we got the outcomes that we expected last session. You think we'll do it this time?
I am hopeful, and I'd ask Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Barnes, maybe just to talk a little bit about a little bit of seed money that went to a couple of our vocational education programs in K-12, one at PCC and one at Sabin-Schellenberg Center. And I was pretty hard on expecting outcomes for the little bit of money that they got last session, and hopefully that'd be an indication that if we can broaden this out statewide, what we can do for our kids.
Okay. Great. Ms. Barnes, you want to tell us about it?
May I be excused, Madam Chair?
Yes, you may, Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, no.
Wait a minute. I got committee members who want to talk.
Yeah.
Senator Schrader. Oh, I mean, Cruz.
Yeah, he's
Schrader.
Most people can tell us apart. he has more hair. I'm Senator Schrader. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you envision, because we heard testimony a couple committee meetings ago about the new graduation standards, graduation requirements, and one of my concerns in that was that we be, if we're enhancing math, that it be, we have the potential of directing it towards career development. And I was just wondering, because I know this has the department reporting to the Board of Education, I'm wondering if there should be a greater nexus in there. Because the tracks are going to be very similar as they're informing what the new graduation requirements are out in time and this works going forward. So I guess I just think we should be mindful that those tracks are proceeding appropriately, and maybe the board should be more involved than just having a report go to them.
No, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would absolutely agree with Senator Cruz. I think the integration is going to be critical if we're going to be successful here, not duplicate or remediate work that's been done by one group or another. So I concur. We are, hopefully, this legislative session, at least as the co-chair's budget comes out, you're going to see a lot of investments in technology and data systems so we can make sure that everyone's talking to one another within the department, across departments, and across the geographic areas of the state. Good point.
It's an excellent point, and we did have some extensive discussion about graduation requirements. A lot of folks are nervous about it, and I think Senator Cruz's point is well taken. Mm-hmm. Senator Wesson? Okay, anyone else? Senator Morse? Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
See you later. Ms. Barnes, state your name and tell us where you're from and what's going on.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Barnes. I am the media communications instructor at the Sabin-Schellenberg Center in the North Clackamas School District. I am also the secondary rep for the Oregon Association for Career and Technical Education, and I served as the vice chair of the Workforce Task Force 2005. I gave you a bunch of information in that yellow folder that brightened your morning, I hope, that you can look at your leisure. But one of the most important issues facing Oregon students this year is how do they meet the new graduation requirements. Career and Technical Education has already proven in the North Clackamas School District and specifically Clackamas County in the state that students who are in our programs do well in the SIM tests, do well with SIM work samples. Graduation rates are higher, and students want to be in school because they see the rigor, relevance, and relationship to what they're expected to learn. Math, science, reading, writing, those are all embedded in our programs. And along the way, they learn workforce readiness skills because all of our programs have the career-related learning experiences and the career-related learning standards. In order to complete a media project, they have to learn teamwork, communication, employment foundations, and by the time they reach their senior year, provide a capstone event. An event that proves to the school districts, their peers, the parents and teachers, that what they've learned for the past 12 years is good enough to be on a regular broadcast station while they're in my program. Career-related experiences mean more to kids in CTE programs because they get a chance at work experience, internships, apprenticeship programs. And in the past, people talked about vocational ed. It's not vocational ed anymore. Kids in our programs not only go on to colleges and community colleges, they go right into the workforce because they know what they need to succeed. And those employers are coming to us now saying, we need those kids trained and we need them now. One of the pieces in the packet I gave you was a press release that came from California this month, and I'll read it to you. The governor of California proposed 2007-2008 budget for the state includes $52 million to improve career technical education programs by enhancing curriculum, increasing teacher recruitment and training, and maximizing bond funds for new facilities. For the past 13 years, I've been a teacher of CTE after giving up a career in broadcasting, and I've seen what these kids can do because of CTE. Next year, there'll be a chance for each one of the kids in our programs to have math credit, science credit, reading credit, and social science credit because of the credit for proficiency program. The reason the study that we conducted last year through the Senate Bill 364, we had 5.5 months to complete our work. I took on the task of doing the research of California, Washington, and other states in this country and realized that Oregon was lagging much further behind than any other state when it came to CTE funding. We know it works. We have the data to prove it, not only in Clackamas County, but ODE shows it on their website to you. I guess what we're asking for now is a bigger chance to show to you with specific data through pilot programs what's working in Oregon, what can we make work statewide for every kid, not only in high school, but the community college and the OUS system. We've had no opposition from any of the groups we've talked to. I've met with the governor's office during the summer. We met with the community college. We've met with Duncan Weiss. And everyone says the same thing. In fact, one lawmaker actually said, why do we need another study? Let's just give CTE the money it needs. I'm asking you now to give us a chance one last time to give you all that data you need so we can have sustainable funding in Oregon for these programs. Because I know they work because I see it every day.
Thank you. And I had remembered that you had left broadcast journalism to do this. I remember this testimony very clearly, and I think I'm going to remember some of these students, too. I remember Mr. Maurer, I think, or Ron Dexter, I think, is the teacher of the program.
Used to be my boss.
Yeah, there you go. See, I remember that. So I don't think we argue about that. I agree with you. I'm kind of wondering why we're spending $250,000 on a study that we already know we need to invest in these programs. But, I mean, we're all data-driven here, especially the gentleman who was sitting next to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll give him the data. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would address how wide is the gap? Clackamas seems to be a little unique, and if you were to survey the rest of the school districts and schools, how wide is the gap between where we should be and where we are today? How many schools have CTE programs?
I do not have that information with me. I know ODE will give it to you, but I can tell you that North Clackamas School District is very lucky. We invest our own money in our CTE programs because Carl Perkins federal funding comes to the state. But the state of Oregon does not have a big chunk of money to also invest in our programs. To answer your question, I don't have that information in front of you. That would be good data for us to show you. But I know as the board member of OACTE at our convention, there's a big discrepancy all over the state. There are some districts that can afford small one or two programs at most. But keep in mind, when the school districts lost the big chunk of change, one of the first ways to go is to cut CTE programs. Voged was on the bottom of the pile with music and PE because they didn't see those as essential. And I understand that. But when you can embed what is needed for those kids to learn in our CTE programs, they should be considered just as important as math or science or social science because we embed those kind of issues in our own classes now.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Barnes. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, I'm going to quickly call up folks, and I'm going to give you a couple of minutes apiece, and that's all we're going to have time for. Nikki Clausen, Alicia Brown, and Danielle Jacobs. Yes. You are. Okay.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Dexter. I'm director of career and technical education at Concordia University, former director at Save and Skill Center, former associate superintendent of current technical education at the Oregon Department of Education. I want to thank Chair Walker and the members of the committee who supported the passage of Senate Bill 364 in the 2005 legislative session. As the author of Senate Bill 364, my goal was to have the legislature appoint a task force to study a number of critical issues facing current technical education and report back their findings. I served as a task force member last year, and the recommendations are summarized in a final report by the Oregon Department of Education, and they're also written into the provisions of Senate Bill 589. In writing 364 in the previous legislative session, I identified six critical issues facing CTE in Oregon. CTE is current technical education. Issue number one, adequate funding of current technical education or high schools and community colleges. Number two, more consistent practices for our dual credit system. Number three, cost-effective CTE instructional delivery models, including skill centers, existing investments in distance education, lack of CTE teacher preparation. And statewide support for CTE student leadership programs. I would suggest to the committee that you consider naming SB 589 Workforce 2007. And in the next legislative session, a proposed CTE bill be named Workforce 2009. The challenges facing current technical education cannot be solved in 2 or 4 years, and I believe it is important to have continuity in the names of bills which are proposed and passed to address these critical issues. The next data I'll give you may answer Senator Morse's question. To understand the number of Oregon students impacted by this legislation, I would like to share the following enrollment data obtained from the Oregon Department of Education. In 2005-2006, there were 77,000 Oregon high school students, or 43%, enrolled in CTE programs, and there were 29,000 community college students, 31%, enrolled in post-secondary CTE programs. I want to let committee members know that current technical education in Oregon is facing many challenges. Our high schools and community colleges are struggling to maintain their CTE programs. Most are not able to offer new CTE programs which students want to take or where there are future career openings in our workforce system. This gets at the question Senator Morse asked about the gaps. For example, Benson High School, at one time a premier career and technical high school in Oregon, will cut 8.6 teachers from its faculty next year. And like other states, Oregon faces a shortage of qualified and experienced CTE teachers. Our high schools and community colleges constantly struggle with maintaining up-to-date current technical technology needed to keep current with business and industry standards. We are behind other states like Washington with a weighted formula for CTE and 10 state-supported skill centers. For students, teachers, and programs to be successful, it is imperative that Oregon invest over the long term in current technical education. SB 589 is long overdue, and your support of this bill takes a very important step in developing a long-range strategic plan. And I'd like to maybe just close by saying that my point of view on the task force results were a little different than Senator Schrader's. We probably had 6 meetings. I was disappointed the task force was appointed late, but there were 18 members appointed by the governor's office, superintendent of public instruction, and the chancellor of higher ed, and president of the Senate, and speaker of the House, and so forth. So that made it kind of difficult. But I will say I was very pleased with the outcome of the report, and I was not disappointed at all in the work that the task force did. It was kind of, the timeline was crunched during the summertime, but I'm not disappointed, and I don't think at all that the task force failed in terms of what Senate Bill 364 set out to accomplish. I was pleased with the results of that. And with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak and to answer any questions you might have.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Dexter? Thank you for still staying involved in this program by being so excited about it. All right, now we'll go to the young women I called up, Nikki Clausen, Alicia Brown, Danielle Jacobs. All the young women in red.
Madam Chair, we obviously didn't get the memo on the dress code today.
We did not. But I have a feeling we have to meet some requirements to wear that uniform. So.
Yes.
All right, ladies, take it away.
Manager. Senator Walker and members of the Chair Committee. For the record, my name is Nikki Clausen, and I am a teacher at Reynolds High School. I'm also the Skills USA advisor. I teach hospitality, tourism, and food service, which is one of the CTE programs. I feel very strongly about the need for career and technical education. I, in fact, am a product of it. Through Cascade High School, I was a Skills USA member and a member of their culinary home ec program as well. I was a state officer and I was a national officer, and it was at that national conference, as I was preparing to go on stage as a senior in front of 15,000 people, that I decided that I needed to be a high school teacher to help the students that were like me. The ones that are in the middle, that don't necessarily get all the supports, that don't necessarily find their niche or the place to get involved, and to help them to find that place and to help them to get involved. And I have 2 students here with me that have found that place in CTE and in Skills USA. CTE provides an opportunity for students to apply what they're learning in all classes. Their education is a wheel. If you take out part of that process, take out part of their education, it won't go as smoothly. They don't find that rigor, that relevance, and those relationships if you take out CTE or if you take out another area of that education. Through my classes, students learn the employability skills to be successful. We have 2+2. We have an on-site restaurant that my students work in. They earn their food handler's cards. We have an on-site catering business that my students work in. And they also have the opportunity for internships. So through my program, they're not only getting the education, they're not only applying the lessons or the skills they're learning in their English and their math and their science, but they're also learning the job skills to be successful. They're learning the leadership skills to be successful. They're figuring out what skills they want to learn or what areas they want to go into after high school to prepare for year 13. I've brought these 2 students with me so they can share their story with you of the lessons that they've learned not only in my class, but also through Skills USA. And I would encourage you, as you look at this bill and as you go through the process of exploring CTE, that you also look at student leadership organizations. They go hand in hand with what CTE offers. In the classroom, in the CTE programs, they have the classroom experience. Student leadership takes it one step further. So they learn the leadership skills, the employability skills, and they also get the opportunity to compete with the lessons that they're learning in the classroom to take it one step further. So I will now turn it over to Danielle Jacobs, and she can share her story, and we'll take questions at the end.
All right, thank you. And just to let you know, members come and go here not because they're bored with your testimony, but this time of year we all have testimony to give in other committees, and so we're running here and there, so don't be offended. All right, thank you. Danielle, do you want to go first?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Danielle Jacobs. I am a junior at Reynolds High School, and I am part of Ms. Clausen's Hospitality and Tourism Pathway. I'm also an active member and a state officer for Skills USA. When I joined Ms. Clausen's class, I kind of saw it on my tour in eighth grade as, oh, it's a cooking class and it looks fun. But when I went into that class my freshman year as the exploring hospitality class, I started to realize that it was more than that. I realized that it was that opportunity in high school to get involved in your classes more than just going each day and doing your work and your homework. I realized that the classes I could take in the next few years, which I am now in the third level of, and I will be taking the fourth internship level next year, that those give me opportunities to actually do the jobs that we learn about. Part of hospitality is a catering business, or being a chef, or being a baker, or running a hotel, and we have learned how to do those skills through her class and actually experience them through the restaurant and the catering business that we run. As a student, I realized that being professional and being responsible is something that every person has to do at some part of life. And through her classes, I've been able to apply the skills that I've learned in my other classes in math and English and even science into her classes. I feel that CTE programs are way more than just cooking or just welding or just automotive classes. They teach kids everything that they need to know for their future lives. The amount of people in the world that are in vocational type jobs is so much that being able to learn those things in high school and get that experience early, I feel is one of the most important things that I've done. Also, being part of Skills USA, I've been able to apply that back to the class. Being in Skills USA, I've been able to travel and I've been able to learn and be more of a leader. Combining those two things, I've been able to realize what I want to do in life, and it has given me some amazing opportunities. I've gone from not knowing anything about what I want to do in college or what my career would be to knowing exactly what I want to do. I learned about hotel management in her class. I saw that I could work in a hotel or a resort. But then, through Skills USA and through the leadership I've learned in her catering business, that I want to be the manager of that hotel. I want to own that hotel. I don't just want to work there.
So I love that.
So $10 yes. off a note.
A powerful woman. Is this what you're learning in her class?
Yes. We learn all of this. We learn how to be that leader, how to take that next step, and how to apply everything we learn every day into real-world situations. And I feel that CTE programs and student leadership organizations have given me the best opportunity ever. So I will now let you guys speak to Alicia Brown.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for not reading your testimony, because we have that in front of us. And so it was really good to just have you talk to us, and that's kind of what we're looking for. But we're going to need to shorten it up just a teeny bit, because we got a bunch of other folks.
Short and sweet.
All right. Thank you.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alicia Brown, and I'm a senior at Reynolds High School and an active Skills USA member. I'll just tell you a little bit about my story. I started out as a shy girl as a sophomore. She was a new teacher at our school, Ms. Clausen was. I was her TA the first year, walked in, completely shocked that it wasn't the teacher from the year before. She got me intrigued by Skills USA, told me what it was about, how to do the leadership portion, just everything that Skills USA stands for. I attended a couple of the meetings, got very intrigued by what it stood for, and was very curious about what this could do for me and how it could help me in the future. From being involved in Skills USA, I've worked my way up. I started as a chapter officer, as a parliamentarian, then I went on to be the Region 1 Vice President for Skills USA, and now I'm a national officer, and I represent 12 states in the United States, and I'm the Region 5 Vice President. Being the Region 5 Vice President as a national officer, I am in charge of those 12 states with participation and being a good role model for them. Through hospitality and the CTE program of Skills USA, I've learned the leadership skills and the employability skills that you need to work in the workforce. Through these programs, it's amazing. You go out there, you do what you're doing, you use the hands-on skills, and for me, I competed my first year as a sophomore in commercial baking at the state level. Surprisingly, I took first. I went out to nationals and competed in the top 2%, and I ranked in the top 30 in the nation. Through that, it was an amazing experience. There's 14,000 people there. The next year, I competed at the state level. I took third, and then I went on to nationals, and I ran as the national officer candidate. And I, on that Friday night, I got introduced as the National Region 5 Vice President, and I got to go on stage. It was the most exciting experience that I've ever had. And now this year, I'll actually be on stage running the entire show with 14 other officers. And through SkillsUSA and my CTE program of hospitality, it's given me more than I've ever thought. And it's opened doors that I never thought could have been opened. And from that, I now have a full tuition scholarship to Johnson & Wales University at the Denver campus. And I'll be attending there this fall. So I'm very excited. And CTE and SkillsUSA have opened doors that I never thought could have been opened. And same with Danielle. Being in her program, it's made me think of more than just wanting to work at a bakery, but I want to own the bakery, and I want to produce it, and I want to be in charge of that. And I want to have a bakery in downtown Portland that everybody wants to come to. And I'm very excited for everything that I've learned and for everything that's to come. And CTE and SkillsUSA have really opened those doors. And I'm very thankful for that, and I encourage you to vote for both.
Thank you. It's clear you've done a great job with these students. They're very poised, articulate, and goal-driven, and I love that about them. We share a passion. I'm a gourmet dessert maker myself, but I do it in my spare time, which I don't have much of anymore.
We haven't seen much this
year. Yeah,
I know, but I can't draw, I can't paint, I can write well, but I can bake one heck of a dessert. And doesn't that make you feel good when you
do
that? Yeah. Well, thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Well,
Senator Metzger.
Just a comment. When you get back to Reynolds, if you run into a student teacher, Miss April Robinson, you tell her, she was my legislative assistant, that you did a great job and really, really impressed. So.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much.
I think she got over her shyness, don't you think?
I think so.
People have told me that.
Really?
I was that shy girl. About 13 years ago.
Yeah, I think we're seeing the value of the program. All right, let's run through these because we've got to get to our next bill. Jason Maurer, Megan Helzerman, and Kevin McCauley. You may not know each other, but you're going to know each other now. I just like to get people up here in threes because it helps move things along. Okay, get started, please.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Maurer. I work with Microsoft as a senior developer evangelist. I'm also a member of the Software Association of Oregon. I chair their developer special interest group. I'm going to be talking specifically in the software development realm a bit. I've been involved in software development for about 13 years now, and I consider myself very lucky because I grew up in Montana. I grew up in a small town. Didn't really have a lot of resources like career technical education to draw upon. I didn't go to college, but I'm sitting here today with a pretty good job, support my family, and it's a job I think a lot of people would enjoy. My particular job specifically is kind of a weird one, developer evangelist. You might think, you know, do I run around with a Bible or something or that kind of thing. But there's with the growth of the software industry, there's a lot of diversification in roles. There's so many different jobs out there that people don't even know about unless they get exposure to the software industry. It's something you're not going to get just by a matter of course by going to college or whatever, because it's something you really need to get out there and see or get exposure to. Microsoft itself right now it's just kind of a sign of the times. It's still kind of a myth that there aren't a lot of jobs out there. Some people still believe there aren't a lot of software jobs out there. It's actually not the case. Microsoft itself has over 8,000 jobs, full-time positions open that they're having a hard time filling. There aren't a lot of qualified people out there. this is a global problem. If they could find the jobs in India, they would get them. They can't. There's just a lot of growth in the software industry. Money Magazine recently had a career survey and rated two of the top 10 were in the software field. The number one position was software developer. For the next 10 years, they estimate 40% growth. It's a great field. It's a good job. They'd be great jobs to have here in Oregon. But from my own experience, I consider myself very lucky. When I was a kid, I had a paper route. I used some of the money I earned to buy a computer out of a mail order Sears catalog because my town was so small we didn't even have a Sears. And I really just kind of learned on my own. And these were during the days before the internet. Things weren't as complex at the time. And I really don't think I could do that today. If I was that age today and looking at even though computers are much more prevalent in society, people are browsing the web, chatting on instant messenger programs, those sorts of things. But the things that we're doing with computers now are much more complex than they were, and there's an even greater need for that sort of education. So I guess the big points I like to get across is that things, as things progress, it gets harder and harder to get into the field. There's a lot more need for qualified people, and I know that the industry itself is more than willing to step in and help participate. I participate in a number of user groups and other things through volunteer efforts, both myself and a number of people who are out there in the field to help educate people. We try to do what we can, but there's only so much we can do. It really needs to be in partnership with educational institutions. And,
all right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I hate to cut you off, we're running now 8 minutes behind schedule.
Understood. I can talk forever about this.
There's like six more people to testify. Thank you. Mr. McCauley, can you keep it, or someone there, can you keep it to just 2 minutes, please?
I can keep mine actually very short.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Megan Helzerman, and I'm the Regional Coordinator for Career and Technical Education with Clackamas ESD, and that's a mouthful. I don't disagree with anything that's been said here today. I want to, in fact, reinforce all of that. I don't feel the need to cover all of this in my written testimony, but it's about the competitiveness of our workforce and the fact that career and technical education programs can't compete for the resources for education as it stands right now. In fact, there's an example where yesterday, as I was preparing this, two programs in my region let me know that they were either closing or consolidating because of a need to increase social studies classes in the same high school. So, but I wanted to focus a little bit of my testimony on one concern I have about the bill, and that is Section 3 of the bill that relates to 2+2 programs. The section of the bill asks the Department of Education to create requirements around and consistencies around the 2+2 programs throughout the state. And my concern is that, with all due respect to my friends at the Department of Education, I don't believe that the knowledge of those programs should come from the Department of Education. I believe that the mandate that there are groups out there that have more knowledge and understanding than the Department of Education of those programs, and ask that portion of the bill be considered a part of the study that's in Section 1 of the bill, so that the groups that are actually out there implementing those programs can provide input and come to some agreement and consolidation amongst themselves, as opposed to coming as a mandate from the Department of Education. As an example, in our region, last year we awarded 17,658 college credits to 1,700 high schools. I think in order to make these programs consistent throughout the state, our region has a lot to lose in order to help bring those other ones up to it, as opposed to if we were to work with those other regions and come to some agreement on our own as a group of providers of those programs. I think that we can all work together to meet those and make those consistent.
Okay, that's really good testimony. I mean, all the testimony is good, but that's important for us to know before we move this bill forward. Have you had a conversation with Senator Schrader about that suggested change?
I have not.
Okay.
But I will if that's recommended.
Yeah, I would recommend you do that. I'll do that as well, but try to get up to see him today, or at least leave him a note before you leave the building. He's kind of hard to get a hold of.
Okay.
But I would recommend that you just leave a note, and then I'll follow up with him.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McCauley.
Hello, it's Chairman Walker.
Mm-hmm.
and other members of the committee. Thanks for letting me speak today. I apologize about my statement because I put down the wrong chairman on there.
Oh, that's okay. I noticed that, but you'll get to them eventually.
Okay. Because
this bill's going to Ways and Means.
Anyway, I'm a current student at Concordia University under with Dr. Dexter. I'm studying CT. My goal is to become a CT business instructor someday. I'm a former lawyer. I've spent a lot of time in school. I spent 2 years in community college, 4 years in college, and graduate school and on to law school. I know a little bit about higher education from experience, not from teaching, but from experience. I totally support this CT situation because I feel like right now in public school, if we don't get with it and do this stuff, that we're really neglecting our children here in Oregon. My children go to public school. I got one in high school, one going to be in high school pretty soon, and I really want to see that they get the best education they possibly can. I think if you do the research, you're going to find that CT is the best way to go, and that you're going to start putting more funding into CT, and eventually we're going to get moving in that direction. We're going to catch up with the rest of the country and maybe the rest of the world and start being competitive out there, not just domestically but globally. As the other gentleman said, we got to get with the program here. I don't want to sound like I'm lecturing, but I really do strongly support this stuff as a parent just as much as a teacher or a future teacher. That's all I have to say, folks.
Well, thank you, and you're a recovering lawyer. There's a lot of you out there.
Yeah, it kind of comes with the territory, you know. We're constantly recovering.
Well, I had a dream the other night. I wasn't sure if it was a dream or a nightmare. I woke up thinking I was in law school, and so I had to think about it.
That's a nightmare, I can tell you from experience.
Well, I've been hearing that, so thank you, Mr. McCauley.
Yeah, education seems like a lot more fun.
All right, Daryl Fuller. Is Barbara, someone named Barbara, with you, Daryl? Okay, come on up. So it's Barbara or Daryl who's testifying? One or the other.
Daryl and I will submit our written testimony if Malcolm Rose.
Okay. Okay, that'd be great. And then Tom Gallagher is around. Tom?
I'll do the written too.
Okay, thank you, because there's no one here in opposition to this bill. So I appreciate that. Mr. Rose, then you can finish up for us.
Thank you for this opportunity, Senator Walker and all other members. I'm a father.
State your name first.
Oh, Malcolm Rose.
And where are you from?
From Corvallis.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Morse's country. I'm a product of hands-on learning. I grew up in a little country called Rhodesia, and I never graduated high school. The only thing that kept me up into the 10th grade was technical drawing, wood shop, and metal shop. Without this, I would have dropped out much sooner. So this is very important to me. I am a little nervous, so please bear with me. I'm a father of 4 children. My first 2 children have graduated. My daughter took medals, became the race car driver for Philomath High School, went to the regional finals up in Canada. She now works for Samaritan. My son, he was the first student to receive honor roll for wood shop in middle school at Philomath Middle School. He is now in the Air Force. He's done his tour in Afghanistan and Iraq, Katrina. So these are 2 products of the opportunity of hands-on learning. I have 2 more children that are now in middle school, will be going on to high school. In 1998, the first of the closings started with hands-on classes in Newport. They shut down the order program. Mel Peterson was the teacher. I met him up at Woodburn while my daughter was racing. He approached me, and we started a campaign to bring back these programs. Since then, I became the president of the Mid-Valley Auto Association, an association we formed with small businesses. We have 22 members, and we have been fighting the closure of all these programs. In 1998, we started with Newport, and we were able to keep it open for 2 years with parental help. They had bake sales. They did everything to raise the money to keep the teachers, but that was only lasted for 2 years without any funding from the school. At that time, I talked to, I believe it was Senator Bruce Starr, and the dropout rate in Lincoln County was 40%. In 2000, Crescent Valley High School in Corvallis, it shut down its order program, wood shop, and everything. Able to bring it back through LBCC, For 2 years, they kept the program alive. The program shut down. Again, we were told it was a shortage of money. That big garage, which was over 10,000 square feet, has been turned into nothing but classrooms now. So they have no opportunities for those two students. 2002, we approached CHS, Corvallis High School. Rob Duvall is the shop teacher. The principal there was very receptive. He got a part-time teacher to help him. We revived the order program, the wood program. They now have over 400 students in that program. Crescent Valley has zero because they don't have any programs. They want to join the CHS, but unfortunately there is not enough money to hire more teachers to let this happen. Corvallis High School built a brand new school, spent over $50 million, spent $5 million on a theater that has 37 part-time students, but yet we have over 400 students. When they did this, they did absolutely zero to the vocational part of the school. Right now, they have no natural gas to three furnaces, which they need for metallurgy. They have a CNC lathe without software just sitting up in the attic because they can't use it. And many other items that I just, well, I won't continue to list them. The dropout rate in at Crescent Valley prior to 2000 was 1.5%. It's now over 4%. Over 300 students a year drop out of school in Benton County, which is roughly 10%. These students deserve a chance. They're not getting a chance. The governor himself said 28% of the people in Oregon have a four-year degree. 72% are vocationally inclined or have a vocational job. Why is it we have such a discrepancy in the school funding? The national average for a four-year degree is 30%. Athletes get to do their field. Many of them are funded privately, but only one or two will actually make the pros. Arts, maybe three or four will become movie stars, whatever. People that do auto, metal, wood shop, cooking, whatever, are all guaranteed jobs when they leave school. Why aren't we funding them?
Thank you, Mr. Rose.
Okay. Are you running out of time?
We are. Oh, your testimony has been valuable. I don't know if Senator Morris has a question of you since he represents your community.
No, I just want to thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you.
And welcome to our country. How long have you been here?
I've been here 30 years. So.
That's great.
That's longer than the chair's been alive. That's great. Oh.
Little does he know. Mr. Rose, your testimony was valuable, and I'm glad that we had a chance to hear it. I'm not going to move the bill today because I want a chance to look at the written testimony that was submitted from folks who couldn't testify today, and there were also a couple of suggestions that were made, but I anticipate moving the bill. I just need to make sure that we address everyone's concerns, and I agree with you. We have a real problem in career technical education in our state.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz has a question for
you.
No,
I do not.
Thank you, sir.
Just a comment before you close.
Okay.
I think I would agree that we should probably look at 2 plus 2 in Section 3. I think there's some unintended consequences there to make statewide. So I think that's something that needs to be looked at. Madam Chair, and I would also suggest that in Section 4, where we are encouraging collaboration of departments, that the boards should also be involved in that collaborative effort. I think if we can do those things, and Madam Chair, my confusion over Sub 1 of Section 45 as I read it further is just reordering. So so it's not any substantive change, it's just reordering the section, so I'm okay with that now.
Okay, and I thought the 2 plus 2 issue was important to look at, too. And thank you for those who submitted written testimony, I appreciate that. I'm going to review it if there's anything in there that we need to change the bill because of. I don't think there is, but you're right about people need someone to fix their cars, and there's not enough training to do that. We'll take a look, and then we'll bring this bill back. All right, thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 589. We will now open a public hearing on two bills, Senate Bill 23 and Senate Bill 652. I'll have Ms. Richardson discuss it, and then I'll ask Senator Gordley to come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 23 expands the definition of eligible students for participation in the Expanded Options Program. It changes program notification requirements. It provides a process for determining duplicate courses and appealing those determinations. It directs school districts and eligible post-secondary institutions to negotiate in good faith a financial agreement for payment of student instructional costs. It allows charter schools to participate in the Expanded Option Program. It allows school districts to request waiver of requirements for participation. The program declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. You have a dash one amendment in front of you that provides a process for parties to appeal to and the Department of Education to determine whether negotiations were conducted in good faith. It allows districts who negotiate in good faith but do not reach an agreement with their partner, allows them to seek a waiver from participating in the program with that negotiating partner. I would note that Senate Bill 652 is similar in all respects, except that it deletes the waiver provisions. It's similar in all respects to the unamended Senate Bill 23.
Okay. Senator Gordley, would you like to come up?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like Salon Noor and Suzanne Gaggett from the Department of Education to join me.
Okay.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Avelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. And I want to thank Mr. Noor and Ms. Daggett for being present this morning to assist me with a part of this presentation. And, Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is suggest that before we go forward with any changes to what is now in the law, expanded options, that we take this opportunity to more fully understand what has been implemented to date. How's it working? How's it working around the state? And I've asked Salam Noor and Suzanne Daggett to help us gain that better understanding with their progress report on the implementation of expanded options. Before they get started, I want to remind us that the purpose of expanded options was to open up more opportunities for students, move more students into higher education courses when the students are ready. And this is an aggressive approach. It is about seeking out at-risk students, including dropouts, including students of color, but it is not a remedial program. It is not a remedial program. It is an effort that recognizes that we have bright, college-ready students in schools now. We have bright, college-ready students who may have dropped out, and we need to reclaim them and get them back on an educational track. By design, those students who can only get into a expanded options program if a receiving community college and or university accepts a student into the program. With that said, let me also commend some information to you. Madam Chair, I don't know if you or members of the committee have had the opportunity to review the Oregon Benchmarks report on the progress of Oregon's racially and ethnically diverse populations. This is a report, the most recent version, or the most recent report, was issued by the Oregon Progress Board in April of 2006. The value of this report is that as we make public policy choices and budget decisions, we need to keep this information and data in front of us to better inform the choices, the policy choices, and the budget choices that we will be making in this session. And I would just take you to a section in the report that is focused on education and that looks at college completion for racial and ethnic populations, racial and ethnic students in our state. And we're learning some things that should guide us and at the same time should also trouble us. Let me find my place here. When we look at the adult college completion rate for African Americans, we learn, again through the Oregon Progress Board, that the adult college completion rate increased significantly from 1990 to 2004. And in 2004 was better than African Americans nationwide. However, the rate remained significantly below the statewide average and benchmark target. When we look at the African American high school dropout rate, we learned that it improved after 2000 and through the 2003-04 school year. However, in 2003-04, the rate was worse than all Oregon groups except Hispanics, the statewide target, and the Oregon average. When we look at the status of American Indians in Oregon, the adult college completion lagged behind most groups in Oregon in 2004. Behind American Indians nationwide and was below the statewide average and target. When we look at the status of Hispanics, we learned that adult college completion was the lowest of all groups in Oregon and lagged behind Hispanics nationwide. And further, we learned that the high school dropout rate for Hispanics improved after 2000 but worsened in 2003-04, and it remained the highest dropout rate of all groups in Oregon in 2004-05 and was worse than the Hispanic dropout rate nationwide. So, Madam Chair and colleagues, that is some information to keep in front of us and some information that helps frame and define what is the opportunity before us in this public policy discussion around expanded options. And I hope, Madam Chair, that your committee will find an opportunity to look more deeply at the Oregon Progress Board report and the other sections in the report that are also focused on education, all of education, pre-K through higher ed. Students cannot participate in expanded options if their parents don't know about the program and the opportunity. And so this is about an aggressive, must be about an aggressive outreach, and particularly to students of color, to get them into educational opportunities. I'm going to stop at this point and turn to Mr. Knorr and Ms. Daggett, let them go forward with their remarks, and I'll have some concluding remarks when they complete.
Thank you, Senator.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you relative to Senate Bills 23 and 652 and the Expanded Options Program. What I'm going to attempt to do is give you an overview of how we got to this stage and the work that has gone relative to the implementation of the Expanded Options Program, and then Suzanne will share with you some preliminary data that we're receiving as a result of the implementation, and I will just stress that we are in the early phases of implementation. This is really the first year of implementing Expanded Options. Just by way of background, Senate Bill 300 established the Expanded Options Program in the 05 session, and many of the partners involved in this process contributed to crafting and designing the program and its features, if you will, that involved the Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon Education Association, the Confederation of Oregon School Board, Oregon School Administrators, COSA. We had citizens involved in the task force that helped frame it and shape it. The post-secondary partners, the community colleges and workforce development, the Oregon University System, and many others were involved in the design and creation of this program, led by Senator Gordley and her vision for providing opportunities for students that typically don't seek out these opportunities, primarily college credit and high school. We know that high-achieving students seek out these opportunities. They participate in AP courses and IB programs and a variety of other options that provide them a chance to earn college credit in high school. The Expanded Options Program, as Senator Gordley indicated, does give priority to students that are at risk and those that have dropped out or are on the verge of dropping out from school. And it does cause schools to be very intentional in terms of seeking out those students, trying to recapture them and bring them back into high school. And also to be really deliberate and intentional relative to the educational opportunity and the design of that opportunity that suits them and their needs. And in some cases, that means accommodating them at the high school or looking for other options at a community college or university that will allow them to finish their schooling successfully. Just want to say, as we began implementing the program, we began to see some technical issues that have surfaced, and they were experienced by all partners, by the K-12 institutions, by the community colleges and universities. So the partners came back during the interim, and the department facilitated a process where we started to look at the implementation challenges that we faced, and as a result, a report was provided to the legislature, and some of these fixes, if you will, have been incorporated into both Senate Bill 23 and 652. And the partners worked very closely together and in good faith to resolve all of these issues and reach consensus on the best way to implement this program and have it truly serve the needs of all students. Just some general observations that we've seen as a result of the implementation before we get to the data part. We're seeing some very deliberate and focused statewide conversations about this special group of students. And typically, we really don't pause long enough to think about these opportunities for them. So we're seeing some conversations about the at-risk student, the one that has dropped out, the one on the verge of dropping out, the one that's having challenges within a high school environment, and perhaps another learning environment would be better for them. And that's very promising, if you will. We're also seeing some stronger ties emerge between post-secondary institutions and their partnering secondary institutions, high schools in particular. The conversations are very focused. The conversation deals specifically with students, and that's really encouraging that we're not really dealing with program design or finances. We're looking at students and everybody's interest to serve that student and serve them well. So the collaboration is very exciting. We have actually a history of collaboration between post-secondary institutions and high schools, but this has taken it to the next step and making it much more deeper and richer. We're also seeing a tremendous level of interest on the part of students and their parents. So this is really getting the attention of parents, and many parents are beginning to advocate on behalf of their students and saying, my student can go to college, my student can actually look at some opportunities for college while they're in high school. So that's a very positive aspect of the program. And also just by the fact that we're looking at serving this specific population that typically does not consider college or does not taking rigorous, challenging academic opportunities while they're in high school, this is really opening the door for many of them to think about college for the first time. And many of those students are first-generation high school completers on the one hand, but also potentially college participants. And that's very positive. Many of the discussions surfaced around with the task force surfaced around the waiver provision. I will share with you that we have about 45 districts that requested a waiver from the current definition of waivers, if you will, which means rather than automatically receiving 50% of the ADMW that's allocated per student to districts, they get to negotiate an actual cost agreement. And what we're seeing actually is as a result of this partnership, agreements are being reached on a regional basis. So, for example, in this area, Chemeketa would actually reach the same agreement with all 33 high schools that reside in its district instead of having individually negotiated agreements between the college and the high schools. So that's fostering a lot of collaboration and a lot of conversation amongst high schools to learn from one another and to share practices and potentially share resources relative to the programs that they offer and the community college. I will stop here, but I will say that it's been really positive. The implementation, in my view, has been very successful. We have lots of technical issues to resolve, and I believe these two bills address those issues, and you will get to hear from the partners today. But I will turn it over to Suzanne to talk about the data that we've gathered so far.
All right, thank you. For the record, my name is Suzanne Daggett. I work at ODE, and this report that you have in front of you is, I want to caution you to know it is first blush. It is basically the first information we've gotten back from the post-secondary institutions. So that's the source of this, not from the high school partners, from the post-secondaries. According to the bill, they're supposed to notify all the students and their parents, the resident high schools and ODE, when students are accepted. We asked that they would collapse that information so we didn't get 1,000 separate pieces of confirmations, yes, you've been accepted at such and such. So they sent us a spreadsheet from the resident high school, the courses that students had signed up for, the number of credits, and so on. Taken all of that information and collapsed it into what you see right now. It is, however, not unduplicated students. So if one student has taken 5 different courses, that what you have in front of you is a list of registrations, not the number of students. So keep that in mind. Let's see here. It's been an interesting exercise to go through all of the data, and you'll see if you have a chance where some school districts have been more successful in getting students into this program and others not. There's a lot of participation at some community colleges compared to others, and OUS system schools as well. And part of it, what we've kind of backtracked with this, and I understand this is anecdotal, this is based on phone calls and communication with people in the different institutions, is that where there have been programs already in place, there is a certain amount of communication already taking place between institutions. So they've developed that and gone forward. Lots of times, however, it either that'll work for them or against them in participation here, because they either develop new ones and go on, or students are very successful in existing programs that this doesn't meet their needs. So whereas you might have one school that has provided a lot of students to go in this, they may not have other similar programs such as dual credit or tech prep. Where on the other hand, you may find some high schools that have little or no participation in this, but they have very developed dual credit or tech prep programs. So I don't want you to take the lack of participation at one school as an indictment that there is no post-secondary connection going on there. Our other data that will come later, as mandated in Senate Bill 300, we will report to you before January of 2008, information from the school districts. We've developed an electronic or website data collection that will give us comparative data for each high school on expanded options versus the dual credit, tech prep, AP, IB, and so on, and the ethnicity of the students that are participating. So we'll have a lot more detailed information to share with you. This is, like I said, first blush. And if you have questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Senator Gordley, did you want to finish up before we ask some questions?
Yes. I would just like to say to you, Madam Chair, and also to my colleagues on the committee, as we look at next steps for expanded options, I trust that this committee is going to make a good decision about what we do next. We have great leadership on this committee, very thoughtful, experienced public policy makers, and I know you're going to ask thoughtful questions of all of us. I would just ask that we keep in mind, again, that we're trying to aggressively and intentionally reach a population of students who are, in fact, at risk, who may not see college as being a part of their future unless the opportunity is put before them. And so our efforts, I can't say the word aggressive enough, our efforts must be aggressive. They must be intentional. And they must be student-centered. And it's about removing the barriers wherever they exist, to opening up opportunities for these students so that we can get them on a college track and claim their potential. I believe that this legislation, which passed out of this assembly last session, was one of the most important educational bills ever to pass out of this institution because it's future-focused. It recognizes that the demographics of the state are changing and that we have to put in place policies with respect to education that serve the needs of all of our students, wherever they are in this state. And that's what this policy is about. Does it need to be tweaked? Are there technical adjustments that need to be made along the way? Probably. But again, I would just ask that we keep our eye on the student, serving the student, and as we move forward. I would also say, as you look at the information that's available to you now about how different districts around the state have been participating, it would be good to talk further with some of those districts. Beaverton, looking at their participation rates, high participation, very exciting. When I look at my own district, Portland, disappointing participation rates. And I've had that conversation with our superintendent and our board members, including our board co-chairs. And it is their intent to look, they are looking at how they have been rolling out this program and what it is they can do differently and more intentionally to reach the student population intended in this piece of legislation. Again, I appreciate very much that we have the opportunity to have this conversation and to improve on a piece of public policy that will better serve our students.
Thank you, Senator, and I thank the department as well. I did go to one of my local high schools, Kalpulia High School in the Bethel School District, and I believe they have 12 or 14 students in this program. And I talked to the students, some of the students that are in it, and they are so excited. And I'm so glad that, you know, it took us a long time, Senator, as you know, to get this bill through the legislature to try to bring all the partners together. And we did that successfully last session. I think there are some technical things that need to be taken care of and addressed, and we'll hear about those in a minute. But the program is doing what it should be doing. But you're right. I'm very disappointed. It appears to me there's only two high schools in the Portland area that are using this program, David Douglas and Wilson.
And if I may say a bit about that, it is disappointing. But again, within that disappointment, there is also opportunity. And I want
right.
to be fair to my district and, again, acknowledge that they're acknowledging they need to look at this and need to work at this at opening up the opportunity. When I consider, for example, that Jefferson High School, which is in Senator Margaret Carter's district, across the street from Jefferson High School is Portland Community College, across the street. So there should be no barriers to students being able to take a course or courses not offered at their high school to be able to take a course or courses across the street. When I look at my own district, Madison High School on Northeast 82nd Avenue, less than a mile away is Portland Community College Southeast Campus, also on 82nd Avenue. No barrier should exist mm-hmm. to a student taking a course or courses not offered at their high school at the community college. So again, you know, it's about being creative, but it is also about removing barriers and being student-centered and being, I want you to remember the data. I want you to remember the information mm-hmm. from the Oregon Progress Board report that talks about the challenge that we have to reclaim, to claim these students who are falling through the cracks or who are perhaps in a place of hopelessness about their educational future. It's our work to go out and reach them, bring them in, and help their parents understand that this opportunity exists. This is something that we can do and must do because it is, again, it's about the future. It's about the future workforce. I mean, these are the nurses. These are the doctors. These are the scientists. These are the future civic leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Well, you're right. And I know when I toured Bethel, Kalapuya High School, some of the students had never taken the city bus before. They had only been in their own little community, and they had to take the bus out to the Lane Community College campus, and that was a big deal for them. And then it was a big deal to be on this huge cement-filled campus. I did notice that there's a number of rural schools taking advantage of this program, which I'm very pleased to see my own high school that I graduated from, Reedsport, on the list. And while this committee was at Reedsport High School, I went over and attended the graduation of some young students. They were 16 and 17 years old, and they had partnered with the local hospital to do a training program for certified nursing assistants. Mm-hmm. And so these students were able to take the class and then be prepared to take the state exams. And they did that partnering with the high school. So this has really opened up a lot of opportunities for students, and I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, I'm so pleased that you mentioned the rural participation because it is very exciting. I do want to acknowledge the issue or the concern around waivers. And what I would say, I'll leave it to others to talk about that issue and the concern there. But I'm not aware of any experience to date, and again, others would have to say differently, but I'm not aware of any experience to date that tells us that waivers are necessary. So I'll leave it to others who may have other information to enlighten the committee about that issue.
Okay. Great.
I also want to thank Salam Noor and Suzanne Daggett for the quality of leadership that they have been providing around this issue and all issues that they have a role in participating in within the Oregon Department of Education. I appreciate them very much. Thank you.
So do I.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just, Madam Chair, I know that you don't schedule bills haphazardly, and I've learned that. And I guess having these two bills following Senate Bill 589, I'm assuming there's a nexus there, and it would be nice before we move anything, that we were kind of informed on the nexus to make sure that that one hand is not going in a different direction of the other hand, so to speak, because they're both pointed in the same direction. It would be nice to make sure that that we aren't doing unintended things, which sometimes we do.
And
so I think we probably have the experts there that can make sure that.
Right. Mr. Noor, do you want to comment? We have some folks coming behind you who I think can address that as well.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I think there is a connection between the two bills, mm-hmm. because both strive to create opportunities for students. And although Senate Bill 589 deals specifically with career and technical education, that's not excluded from the opportunities Senate Bill 23 and 652 would provide students. So when we look at post-secondary connections or college credit opportunities for students in high school, we're looking at all courses and all programs, vocational education, which we refer to as professional technical education in Oregon. Senate Bill 589 proposes that we change the name to career and technical education. But we look at AP courses, IB programs, tech prep, 2 plus 2. The intent behind it is really to focus on the student's education plan. What does the student intend to do in their future, and then customize the learning experience to accommodate that. And I believe both accomplish that and complement one another very well.
And I'm sure, I guess it's just a matter of when we look at future workforce needs in the state of Oregon, technical training, I mean, is there's going to be a huge vacuum there. Senator Metzger has recognized that as well during our interim, and I just don't want to miss the opportunities to state that and put it on the record as we mm-hmm. move forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just mm-hmm. add a piece of information to that? As Mr. Rose, when he was up here, indicated, a lot of school districts have had to cut their career and technical education programs, and often that those programs have been picked up by the community colleges. And as I went through the list of courses that these students were taking through Senate Bill 300, some of them are machine shop, welding, auto brake system. So they are capitalizing on this opportunity to take those courses as well. So where there's one path closes, another one perhaps opens. That's not to say that the high schools can't use career and technical education, but this is perhaps augmenting that.
Then augmenting is a good word.
Yes.
Thank you. All right, thank you, all three of you. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up Ms. Wimmer Whalen, who's representing the Expanded Options Coalition. Did you have someone else that's coming up with you?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association, its 46,000 K-12 and community college members, here with a coalition of folks who all are part of a work group that's been mentioned in previous testimony that worked together with the Senator as she provided leadership last session to provide a compromised version on the expanded options program you've been hearing about this morning, and who also met during the interim not only to fix problems with the original 2005 draft, but also to address new issues that emerged as the program was implemented on the ground. And we came up with a list that we worked on collaboratively throughout the interim, which will be found in Senate Bill 23, and it is the complete list of all our negotiated changes and improvements and remedies for drafting problems with the original bill. It mirrors Senator Gordley's version almost identically. There were just a couple little places where we felt that a couple pieces had been dropped or missed, and we wanted to see the entire list addressed. In fact, they appeared to us to be the most important remedies around which we had coalesced during the interim. I handed out to you one of my charts, which I do to try to deconstruct technical stuff and make all the issues match up so that you can see the difference between the two bills, why we felt those issues were necessary to address, and what we did to change them. You also have a dash one amendment, which fixes just a drafting error in Senate Bill 23. Originally, we had planned on the issue of negotiating the amount
schools would send to the receiving higher ed institution. We had this language in the bill, but something mysterious happened on the way to the printer, so we had to fix that at the last minute, and that's why the dash ones are before you on Senate Bill 23.
Never happened before.
Well, no, it's final.
Yeah, I think all of us can
relate to that.
Not that
they're overworked down there or anything.
No.
we all put such a burden on them. Our coalition included representatives from K-12, from higher ed, from community colleges, from business represented by Associated Oregon Industries, which was a lead partner on the original bill, as well as on this coalition fix, and also members from the Department of Education who are implementers and who had a lot to do with writing the regs in the interim and so on. The most important issue that I'd like to draw to your attention is on the back of the chart. It's the two of the financial issues, and you've heard addressed the issue of waivers. The most fundamental and necessary piece that the Oregon Education Association, I will say speaking for my organization, needed in order to support the bill in 2005 was the opportunity to acknowledge that with an unfunded mandate comes pressures on at the district level that may choose one set of children over another. We have thousands, tens of thousands of kids already participating in dual credit programs of one description or another voluntarily. And what tends to happen with mandates is that gets to the head of the line. And we didn't want to see programs such as the Career Technical Education program you just heard about this morning be dropped off in favor of another program if it was a matter of those choices. And as you all know, we've lived through the last 7 years, the financial issues are such that it sometimes was a zero-sum game. So we wanted to make sure that a district would have the ability to opt out of the program if they were offering something else that they already had in place and didn't want to disrupt those students. That was one piece. Secondarily, we wanted to have an adverse financial impact waiver for more general purposes that we might not be able to imagine sitting here, but which districts had been coping with. And so we wanted to be able to have, at least for a biennium, an ability to opt out of the program if it meant that the brick-and-mortar programs that were being offered to the rest of the students in that district would suffer because of offering this unfunded mandate. So those were the two kind of bottom-line issues that the Oregon Education Association needed in order to sign off on the bill in 2005. And through yet more mysteries of drafting, that didn't happen. That waiver got put into a particular section of the bill and therefore applied only to that section of the bill and not to the entire program. And so that fundamental thing was never remedied for us. And so that is the chief difference between the Senate Bill 23 version and the Senate Bill 652 version that you are considering today in terms of our coalition fix. The second issue has to do with how we negotiate around the amount of money that is sent from ADM dollars that the student brings to in order to enroll at a community college or four-year institution as a part of this program. We thought we had the language right in the initial version of the bill. Our partners at the post-secondary level didn't feel that, and as we worked back and forth in collaboration over this, what we finally came down to was that just as there were in the voluntary programs a variety of arrangements that could be made around money, around how much any individual, some kids take one class, others are taking their whole program there, that ought to be negotiated between the sending and receiving institutions. And so we simply mirrored the charter school language around good faith negotiations, and we asked that the Department of Ed be the arbiter of whether or not that process was conducted in good faith if either side should appeal to the department for intervention if there is impasse. So our vision in the dash one amendment is that if either side should appeal because they're at impasse and don't feel that the negotiation was conducted in good faith, the department would conduct a review of that process, determine whether or not good faith existed in the negotiation. If not, send the parties back to the table. If so, assume that the financial issues for that school district were such that they would get the financial waiver found in Section 10 of the bill. So those are the only two changes. The rest of the bill is identical to Senator Gordley's version of it. And rather than read you all the pieces, I will just say as an overview, we clarified what the original intent was of all of the parties with respect to some of the student eligibility pieces. We also made sure that notification and timelines were more realistic. We took a wild guess when we wrote them originally, and we've since found through the schools as they've implemented them that either for the sake of students coming late in the school year and being deserving of an opportunity beyond the original notice window of having the opportunity to participate for the following school year. In addition, schools that were trying to reach students who had already dropped out of school, for example, needed more time to find those kids. We also found, by the way, with respect to the waiver language, I wanted to make one other point, and that is that the comment was made that there wasn't an awareness of any problems existing with the existing language of the bill, and my office did receive several calls, actually from administrators of districts who were struggling to keep their AP programs if they were going to be funding this because there was so much interest in the one. It was they just didn't have enough resources for it all, and it miscalculated, and so we'd gotten several calls about struggles implementing. And if there are places where the participation is lower, it may have something to do with that. We believe that if we fix this and have that waiver option out there and also recognize that there are other programs in place that are working for students and they may just be choosing those instead, that we will actually probably increase participation by districts because they'll feel that they have their bases covered.
Well, Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, I remember that discussion, and that was what kept the bill from being passed for all those years, is that districts felt that if we opened up the floodgates, so to speak, we'd be losing a lot of money to the local K-12 program, and we'd be investing it all in this expanded options program. And that's why we told the TAG folks last session that we couldn't expand the program. We had to keep it narrow and take baby steps and see how we would do, and then we would gradually expand the program. Do you remember that discussion?
Madam Chair, I do.
And Mr. Bennett's shaking his head. So, or nodding his head. Nodding.
Yeah. Up or down. Or sideways.
Get that. Takes me back to my court reporter stuff. There's a difference between a nod and a shake. But anyway, I remember that clearly, and I've gone out and discussed it with the local districts, and it's working fine other than some of these issues. Now, they've not had the issues that you've pointed out, but let me ask this question. I know I was on the email list for all of these meetings, and these meetings were held throughout the interim, and as you know, I was a little busy this interim, and so I couldn't attend any of the meetings, but I read all of the emails that were coming through, and I was aware that this work group was working and trying to iron out any problems with the bill. So there are technical problems that need fixed in addition to these two major issues that you've talked about today. You'd all agree to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think we would. And I've spoken enough. Maybe I could hand the mic over to the rest of our coalition partners, and they can also weigh in.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I won't go into any of the detail that Lori did. She's covered it more than adequately, and I think described completely the kind of outcomes we saw from the work group during the interim. Last session, Madam Chair, our organization was one of the first to join Senator Gordley in support of this concept. For many sessions, there had been, a real lack of support for this kind of program. I think, in part, relying heavily on the broad opportunities that already exist. We currently involve between 20 and 25,000 students in a variety of programs comparable to expanded options. The genius of Senator Gordley's program was the target group that she identified and the real need there. And perhaps the lack of imagination on everyone's side to realize that at-risk students really needed to be approached as a very separate and special group of students to be included in this program. But what I guess I want to point to is that although this program currently has reached 1,352 students, please add that to the
20,000 to 25,000 other students we're reaching, and realize that this is only a beginning. This is really early in this program. We're very excited about what's going on with it. We think with these changes, it only gives the opportunity for more and more districts to more comfortably move into this kind of program. I just can't say strongly enough just how excited we are by what's going on here, and that this really begins or continues, I guess, a program of creating the seamless P20 we're all, I think, looking for. And we hope that you will pass the bill that came from the interim group and allow us to continue to work on this, report back to you next session. I can assure you with larger and larger numbers of students being found and hopefully directed into this really outstanding program.
Okay. Mr. Levine?
Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Levine. I represent the Oregon Community College Association, and I'm also the former president at Rogue Community College in Southern Oregon. My colleagues have gone through and done a very good job of explaining some of the changes in Senate Bill 300 that are being proposed in actually both of the bills. We did see the new amendment this morning on the basically what I would call the mediation arbitration section of the bill, and we can agree to that amendment as well. It's been a very interesting discussion. I've been involved in 30 years in Oregon community colleges, many of those years dealing with issues between K-12 and the community college system. For the most part, they've been very good conversations and negotiations. Other times they've been very difficult, and they've been usually very difficult because there always seems to be money involved going from one system to another to deal with something that we all love, children, kids, and how they are educated and how they can be best educated. I was very happy to see Senate Bill 300 pass as a way to get the parties to the table to start talking about that particular issue. How do we deal with kids? How do we deal with kids that are at risk? The initial data that you've got in front of you shows that the program at the start has been successful, and as my colleagues have said, it'll be even more successful as we go forward. I'm sorry that Senator Cruz left the room because I was going to comment on the comment that he made about how the three bills that you're hearing this morning kind of fit together. Professional technical education at all levels has taken a very hard hit over the last three bienniums, mainly again due to the amount of revenue that's available to colleges as well as to K-12. I need to talk just very briefly about the community college issue. The last gentleman that spoke to you on the very first bill, I don't remember his name, talked about programs being cut. And I'd like to just explain just very briefly the rationale as to what happens. In a program at a community college, an automotive program, for instance, that serves 24 students, probably has an average cost to the institution of about $500,000 to $600,000 to serve 24 students in a given year. It's a very expensive program. When budgets are cut over a period of time and a very slow process in restoring those budgets, it's very difficult to bring those programs back once you make the cut. At a cost of $500,000, community colleges probably could deliver somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 transfer-level courses where students are sitting in a classroom, and there's not any equipment around. It's just a very simple classroom of 20 to 25 students and a teacher, an instructor, faculty member. I bring that up because our budgets are up again. You'll all be involved in that, and I just would like to plant that little seed in your mind. When we take a look at education budgets, the less we do, the more tends to get cut in areas that serve very specific groups of students. Actually, this particular set of students that we're talking about right now, there becomes fewer and fewer activities for them. I call that my little commercial for community college budget, and I feel obligated to mention it when we're talking about at-risk students and career and technical education. With that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I'm sure you'll have questions for all of us when we finish. Thank you, Mr. Levine.
Mr. Green, you didn't sign up. You snuck in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Board Association. I didn't mean to sneak in, Madam Chair. I apologize about that. And for that, I will keep my comments brief on this. But I was part of the work group that worked on this during the interim. And I can say that when you look at the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 23, that's really the consensus piece where everybody coalesced around. And I think Mr. Levine just indicated some of those negotiations were pretty tough. As you do work groups around issues like this, and they focused on money, primarily, but I think we've got a good agreement in the Dash 1 amendments, and that's what I'm here to support. A couple of things I would point out to you. As I look over the list that Ms. Daggett gave you from the Department of Education, I'm encouraged by the fact that if you take a look at that list, those were the type of schools that Senate Bill 300 was identified to provide services to, those small rural school districts. If you take a look down that list, primarily that's what we're serving in this program. And let me give you an example, one that I'm very familiar with. If you take a look at page 1 of 4 of the chart that she gave you showing the number of registrants, and you look at Chemeketa Community College, and my school district here in town is Salem-Keizer, you only see two high schools that are in that program, McNary and Roberts. And Roberts is the alternative high school that the Salem-Keizer School District started to address at-risk students, pregnant parenting teens, dropouts, a variety of other folks who they're trying to retrieve back into the program. What's noticeably absent from that list are the five other large high schools in the district. And I graduated from Sprague High School here in Salem-Keizer. They participate in a program like this. When I graduated from Sprague, I graduated with 27 credit hours because of an agreement that the Salem-Keizer School District had with Chemeketa. That agreement continues today. And one of the pieces of data that you don't see are those 20 to 25,000 students that Mr. Bennett mentioned who are already doing this program. Senate Bill 300 was an attempt to get at those schools and at those kids where school districts don't currently have those arrangements. And I think you see that when you look down the list. I'd be really interested in what's going on in Portland, because I believe Portland has a huge agreement with PCC to provide programs for these with their high school students. At least the last time I checked, there was still that agreement in place. I know with the Salem-Keizer School District, that agreement still exists. So you're missing some high schools there, but that's not to say those students aren't being served. There's programs and services being provided to them that are part of additional agreements outside of the Expanded Options Program. And one of the things I think that's very interesting will be the report we see from the Department of Education. Ms. Daggett mentioned that they plan to have that to you before January when they're required to have that to you. And they're going to look at a number of things, because if you take a look at ORS 340.085, that says what the report has to have in it. And it'll look at issues of small and rural schools and their participation. And it'll look at issues of ethnicity and minority students providing in the program. And I think when we see that data, that'll really help decide where we go with this program. One of the things you've probably heard me say over and over this session, and I'm going to say it again, you require school districts to make data-driven decisions now with regard to our testing, with regard to our scores. We ask that when you look at programs like this, you do the same thing. Make data-driven decisions that do the best thing for boys and girls. And I think before we see that data, and I think it will be interesting to see where we broke down across the state, I think it's important for us to make the changes we need to do that technically fix the bill and where the agreements were struck, but not make wholesale changes until we see the data back and really get down on the information on serving boys and girls. But I can tell you from my experience and working with my local school district, there are agreements in place that serve kids outside the expanded options programs that still have the same opportunities and alternatives for those boys and girls.
Thank you. Well, Kalpuya High School isn't even on this list. They have a Willamette, but Kalpuya is the alternative.
I thought I saw Kalpuya on the list.
I didn't see it on page
under
3.
Under Lane Community, yeah, I think that's the first
in
high
the back
school.
Section.
Oh, in the back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On page 2 of the chart, Appendix B, Kalpuya High School has 20 registrants. Now, that may not be 20 students.
No, it's like 12 or 14.
It may be 12 okay. or 14 who've doubly registered. You know, if you look down
and
this
that's
list,
the alternative high school.
Right. A lot of them are. And if you look at some are even charter schools in the state that are providing the service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Great. Ms. Zavala, you weren't signed up either. How am I going to manage my committee if you folks just keep stepping up to the plate here? What's your question? Your comment.
Walker, Madam Chair, for the record, Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. I came up to the table just to share our support as well, not only for the amendments, the Dash 2 amendments, but for this bill, Senate Bill 300. We worked very closely with this coalition last session. I just wanted to express that we will are confident that the Department of Education will give a thorough and a robust consideration to the issues, the financial issues between the sectors. So.
And I see that OUS has 4% of the students, according to this list here, if I'm reading it right. Community colleges have 96%.
Right.
So you're getting some of them. Now, you mentioned a Dash 2 amendment. I think you meant
sorry,
a Dash 1. Okay. I just want to make sure you weren't talking about an amendment I don't have.
No, they're the Dash 1. I have two bill folders in my stack here.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I need to hear from Mr. Andine and Mr. Jackson. They were both signed up to testify. They actually signed up. Ms. Wimmer Whalen, did you have any parting comments? Okay. No, I'm not going to move these bills today because I want to just take a look and have a conversation. Mr. Andine?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gary Andine, the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent College Association. Independent colleges have had a long interest in support of this program, but we are not part of the program at this point. As I told you a few weeks ago, there are actually more independent private colleges and universities in Oregon than there are public colleges and universities in Oregon. And we would like to ask for an amendment that would include our institutions as eligible to participate. We do serve a great number of low-income and disadvantaged students, and we do it very well. We're in a number of the neighborhoods in which this program would want to target students, and I think it would be appropriate at this time to ask that our institutions be included. I've given you a couple of different amendments, one that would include all degree-granting institutions in the state, and the other that would include only nonprofit degree-granting institutions. Either amendment would be welcomed at this point, Madam Chair. That's all I have.
Okay, well, just another reason why I'm not going to move these bills today, because this is news to me that you want to be added, and I can't recall whether you were in the discussion before. I think you probably were. But as I indicated, we were taking baby steps with Senate Bill 300, and that might be why you're not included. So I will have a conversation with some folks and get back to you.
Madam Chair, to respond very quickly, I believe we were in the original bill last session, but then we were taken out towards the end, and we decided not to make a fuss at that time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Mr. Jackson.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jay Jackson. I am the president of People Involved in Education, which operates Sandridge Charter School in Lebanon School District and Sweet Home Charter School in Sweet Home School District. I'm also the president of the League of Oregon Charter Schools. And in the interest of full disclosure, I would mention that many years ago, I was Senator Cruz's roommate in the freshman dorm across the street. I don't think that counts for much.
Well, it might if you have lots of stories to tell us. We'll have a conversation after committee because we're way behind today. But anyway, your testimony about this bill is?
I would briefly like to call the committee's attention to a group of students that I believe are overlooked and possibly even discriminated against under the Expanded Options Program. I don't have a problem with the program or the concept itself. However, I'd like to speak on behalf of charter school high school students who realistically are prevented from taking part in this program. Under the current system, students, for example, at our charter school in Lebanon School District are required to drop out of the charter school and enroll in Lebanon High School in order to apply to be eligible for expanded options. The option to get around that is if the charter school and the district can negotiate a new charter agreement allowing the charter school students to participate. My concern is one of the changes in both these Senate bills, while it I think the intent is to clarify the situation. In reality, I don't believe it makes any change for charter school students. I'd call your attention to Section 9, Sub 1, on page 5 of SB 23. It simply states that public charter school may elect to participate. But that's contingent upon the charter school being able to get the district to come to the table and negotiate that change, that amendment in the charter agreement. There is no motivation, no incentive for a sponsoring district to do that. And I would also call the committee's attention to the fact that while there are appeal processes provided for in this bill for students, that does not apply to a student at a charter school. There are appeal processes provided for both the high school and the community college in terms of their negotiations. However, there are no appeal processes for a charter school who simply is unable to get their sponsoring district to come to the table to negotiate an amendment in the charter agreement. And as one brief final point, I would ask the committee if they would take a look at page 204 of the Appendix B that was just presented to you on the registration numbers. If you look under Lynn Benton Community College, Sandridge Charter School is sponsored under an agreement with Lebanon Community School District. And if you look at the registration numbers, you'll see that Lebanon District accounts for 387 of the 420 registrations at the community college. I would submit that there is no incentive or motivation for that district to come to the table and negotiate and make this program available to our students at the charter school. I would submit that's an issue that should be addressed, and I would respectfully request that this committee consider that.
Okay. Thank you. I need to ask Mr. Noor to come up. If you could step down, gentlemen. Mr. Noor, do you know offhand how many of these schools in this Appendix B are charter schools?
Madam Chair, we don't know specifically which ones are charter school, but the bill does not actually preclude charter school students from participating.
Charter schools
are considered to be public schools, and if the charter school is a high school, the students at that school are actually referenced in the bill by the eligibility criteria that it's a high school student that's in 11th or 12th grade and 16 years of age or older. So although the original bill was silent on charter schools, it doesn't suggest that charter school students would be excluded from participation. I think it's important to consider, though, that some charter schools have specific provisions in their charter that were negotiated with the sponsoring district, and they may need to go back and negotiate some agreements. But in terms of the intent of the bill, as it was passed in 05, it does not preclude in any way charter school students from participating in this program.
Okay. And Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Just a question, Mr. Noor. Do you think it would be appropriate for them to have an appeal option in renegotiating, or is that option already available?
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, I would suggest that I'm not a legal expert by any means, but I would suggest by default a charter school that's part of a school district would have that option. Typically, a lot of these agreements are negotiated between the district and the college, not necessarily on an individual school basis. So if there are multiple high schools in a district, what we see is an agreement between the district and the college that the students will participate in, so there is consistency in implementing the law. So any negotiations would apply to all schools within that district and all students within that district.
And Mr. Noor, because a charter school, my understanding, is part of a school district.
Yes.
They sponsor the charter school, and they take a little percentage of the money to administer the school within the district, correct?
Yes. Okay. That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, we are, way behind, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 23 and 652. I'll bring one or the other back at some point, but not today. Okay, we're going to go till about 10:25, but that still doesn't leave me enough time for both bills. So I'm thinking, since there are some school nurses here, Sasha, are you here? You're all local people, right? Okay. How long are you going to take on this? Our other bills got complications. Okay, I'm sorry, but a 533's got a complication, and I need to get it worked out today because it's making me agitated. All right, thank you. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 533, and I'm going to have Ms. Richardson talk to us about the amendment, and then I'm going to call up some people, and we're going to get this one resolved today.
Madam Chair, the amendment to Senate Bill 533 replaces the original measure. It defines asthma and asthma medication, which does not include non-prescription medication. It specifies where the rules may allow asthma medication to be self-administered. It adds requirements for rules to be adopted for self-administration of asthma medication. It allows the school to revoke permission to self-administer asthma medication. It absolves certain school personnel from liability for a student's self-administration of asthma medication under certain circumstances. And it exempts youth correctional facilities.
Okay, Mr. Okulich, can you trot yourself up here, please? And I also want to hear from Ms. Zirkel.
Chair Wilson.
Yes.
Do you want Barbara Stewart from the Lawn Association to join us as well?
I don't care. I just want to get this resolved.
And Marilyn Hudson from the Oregon State Board of Nursing also came.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't have room for four people, okay. And you're the one that's been writing me.
Yes, ma'am.
So it'll be you that will be here. This is not a public hearing. This is a work session. So we've got an amendment in front of us. Mr. Okulich, tell us about the amendment beyond what Ms. Richardson just told us about. Who was involved in the drafting? Why can't we expand it? And what the problem still is?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here with the American Lung Association of Oregon. The Dash 1 amendment that you have before you was sort of a product of several work groups. We originally had sort of an internal process in terms of we took some of the concerns from the hearing last time. One of them was Jim Green from the School Board Association wanted to specify that asthma medication in school wasn't provided by the school, that it was actually provided by parents. So we took care of that. And secondly, we sat down sort of internally in terms of working out some of what we thought would be some clarifying language in terms of where the asthma medication or where this would apply to. And you'll see in front of you on page one, it's school property and dealing in school, school-sponsored activities, stuff like that. We also added the definition of asthma. There was some concern about that. We took that from the Asthmatic School Children's Treatment and Health Management Act. In terms of sort of a larger group, we had a meeting yesterday where we sort of sat down with the School Nurses Association. It was the woman from the Department of Ed. And so that's who was at that meeting. We brought a draft of sort of just an initial draft to that meeting, and we sort of wanted to sort of work through that draft and try to address some of the concerns. I think we were able to address some of them. I don't think we were able to address them all. A couple of things that we did talk about is we took out non-prescription medication. I'd already talked about the parents providing the meds. One of the issues that I think the school nurses brought up was the ability for a school to revoke the permission for a student to self-administer asthma medication if this kid wasn't being responsible with it or, he was abusing, what he was doing with it. So That's sort of what is reflected in the amendment, the dash one amendment that you have here. I do understand the school nurses have some more concerns with it. I can address them as what I think some of them are. Carol is also here and probably could raise some of those concerns.
Okay. We got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
5 minutes here. And I'm going to remind everyone that this committee was very interested. Senator Cruz, I have my note right here. There's a frustration here. We should be able to use our inhaler. You testified, Mr. O'Coolidge, that there are several deaths of students, one who died while the inhaler was locked up in the principal's office. This committee gave direction to you all to try to expand it to make it more than about asthma. It can't be done under the relating clause of this bill because it is so narrow. So the only way to go beyond this issue of asthma, which is a single issue which you're concerned about, is to have someone drop a priority bill to do that. I don't think anyone wants to give up one of their priority bills to do that because they feel that we can address it next session since we couldn't get it this session. Unless there's someone on this committee that wants to use a priority bill, we want to at least deal with the issue of asthma. So, Ms. Zirkel, tell us what your problem is, your concern about this new amendment.
The primary concern is that there are far more students out there using auto-injectable epinephrine for a severe allergic reaction. This bill, they would be then under a different law. They would be discriminated against in this law in that if an asthmatic student in that school could carry his epinephrine and they could not. And there are far more of those children out there. The other major concern is that the ability of a kindergarten-level student, a five-year-old, being developmentally able enough to carry his own epinephrine or even his own inhaler, and also the fear for their safety because these medications could be stolen from them. They could be harmed on the playground or on the bus or walking to school because they are medications that are being abused in schools. And the final concern, the major concern also, is in number in B, requiring the students to demonstrate primarily also licensed healthcare professional.
Okay.
It needs to be an Oregon licensed healthcare professional. But also, there's no requirement in here for the student to demonstrate to anybody at the school level that they are capable in that setting, which is a far different setting than in a controlled doctor's office with mom standing right there.
Okay. Senator Cruz just passed me a note.
Yes.
He's willing to use his priority bill to get something to fix this. I don't, discrimination against other students, I understand the issue. Lots of kids need their EpiPens. Telling me that a kindergarten can't handle their inhaler, I'm sorry, but a doctor wouldn't give them an inhaler if they couldn't handle it and they didn't get the instruction. My daughter had asthma. She had an inhaler. She knew what to do with it, and she had it on her at all times. We had an extra one in the car. We had an extra one at home, and she carried one in her backpack. And her backpack was stolen one day at school, and then it disappeared, and she called home and said, "My backpack's been stolen. I need my inhaler." But we took care of that. But you can't have an inhaler locked up in a closet and a student needing it, waiting for it to get open. So Senator Cruz is going to use a priority bill so that we get all of these medication issues together. So since he's offered to use a priority bill, I'm going to have him work with you all to get the language you want. And we're only going to do this once. So.
And Madam Chair, I'm willing to do that with the proviso that this is going to make sense. This isn't going to be a bureaucratic anything. This is about kids having access to what they need when they need it.
That's exactly.
And I'm not going to tolerate a whole lot of nonsense. But I think the chair would agree with that.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
And I think Senator Courtney will be fine with it as long as we get the asthma medication in there and we do all those other things. So I'm going to leave it up to Senator Cruz to call a work group meeting together. And if you can't show up, I'm sorry, but, we got to move.
Contact my office. We'll set something up.
So we're going to get this bill out. We're going to reschedule it, and we're going to take care of the problem. Okay?
Thank you.
That's good.
Thank you all. I'm going to close a work session on Senate Bill 533, and I'm going to close this committee, and we will carry over Senate Bill 448, hopefully to the next agenda or as soon as we can get folks up here, but we're pretty full. So I'm not sure. We've got charter schools on Thursday. All right, we'll get it on as soon as we can. Thank you.